Welcome to the Unconquered Podcast.
One of the issues with our team right now is mental toughness, discipline, and execution.
Blame no one. Make no excuses. Do something.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Unconquered Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Jason Staples. Haven't put out a podcast in a little while, but plenty of stuff has released. Plenty of stuff has happened over the past few weeks it's about time. I figured it'd be about time to get an update out there and talk about a few things and address a few questions and so on. So here we are. Before I start, I do want to thank Luis Marquez of Keller Williams Realty in Jacksonville for his support of the podcast. As always, if you have any real estate needs in the greater Jacksonville area, Yulee, wherever you are down in that neck of the woods, Lewis is the person to go to get the very best in real estate listings. He'll outwork anybody in terms of finding you the best possible property and making sure that you get the best possible price as well if you are on the market looking for a property. And even if you aren't looking in Jacksonville for a property, if you're trying to buy a house somewhere in Florida, give Lewis a call and he'll make sure you're hooked up with the best possible real estate agent wherever you're going to be going. All right, well, let's get to it. Had a few things, so I've been releasing some videos on the Patreon page as usual, and I've been going through quite a bit of the spring game, going through, looking at, in particular, focusing a lot on the line of scrimmage, looking at some of the X's and O's differences from last year to this year and so on. One thing that's really stood out has been significantly better technique from the offensive tackles, and also the way that the offensive line has appeared to know their assignments. And I know that the latter seems like it's, pretty basic and all of that. But I was told that there were times last year where plays were called and the offensive line simply did not have any idea what their responsibilities were, what their assignments were. There were some significant disconnects in terms of how things were taught, in terms of practice time allotments and so on. And just generally speaking, the offensive linemen never felt prepared last year going into games. And again, I want to be very clear about this. This is not a one coach issue. This is not a Greg Fry issue. This was an issue with Greg Fry as part of the larger staff, which was in terms of the offensive staff at Florida State, was quite dysfunctional last year. And just seeing the functionality of the Briles and Clements offense, and really it is their show. They're running what they want to run and they're teaching it the way they want to teach it, and it's the way that they've installed it for years. It's very clear how much more unified things are. And you know, there were a few missed assignments here and there up front, just a few, and a couple of which were by freshmen, so it's what you expect. But overall, you're looking at an offensive line that actually looks passably okay. Now, at the tackle position, there are still concerns, no question. But on those videos, I've spent a lot of time addressing some of those differences, addressing some of the technique improvements that we're seeing, and even Juwan Williams and Abdul Bello have looked passable at those positions. And again, you got to remember those guys were not, you know, chopped liver recruits. They actually have physical talent. The question is whether they're too far gone to be able to contribute at this point, but in terms of not having been developed. But listen, there are some bodies that they're developing. And as I said on the last episode, Clements is telling people behind the scenes that he feels that they can be decent on the offensive line, that they're going to be okay. And in those breakdowns, as I've spent more and more time looking closely at each play on the line of scrimmage, I can see why. Now, I have gotten some questions about this, and I know that there's some stuff circulating on social media and message boards about some of this stuff as well. And I got a question about a week or two ago asking the following. So I heard a statement from somewhere that Randy Clemens doesn't ask much from his tackles, which got me somewhat excited. Do you have any idea about that? And could you explain it to a non-offensive line guy? And this is an interesting question. This is an interesting discussion. And to some extent, it's true. Randy Clemens doesn't ask as much from his offensive tackles as a lot of coaches do. The requirements placed on the offensive tackles to, say, hold up in pass pro are less in the Briles scheme than in a lot of schemes. And there's a couple reasons for that. And again, it's easier to explain based on with film, but I'll do the best I can in the podcast medium. The easiest way to explain this is that in the running game, the Briles system uses a lot of double teams. So you're going to see the offensive, it's a veer based system in the run game as much as anything else. The veer is the old, it's an old triple option system actually. But it's an option system that basically doesn't block certain players. You'll option that player in order to get double teams at the point of attack. And the Briles system does a lot of that, whether they're optioning with some sort of play action or some sort of pass action or some sort of RPO where it's a give or a throw, you know, down the field or a throw to the perimeter, or some sort of quarterback involved in the run game, or even a boot threat. They're finding ways to, say, leave the guy at the end of the line of scrimmage unblocked in order to be able to get a double team using the tackle and the guard to get push inside. One of the other reasons for that is that the Briles system does a lot of its running. There's a lot of the running game in the Briles system that's done between the guards, and the tackles generally are helping out in there as well. But a lot of the Briles run game is really B gap to B gap, and it's focused heavily on the A gaps, the gaps between the guards and the center. And that's because they like to use space so much outside in the passing game, and they spread you out so wide that they want to be able to get vertical in the run game right away. And so they're going to use a lot of power principles, a lot of dart, which has got some double teams, some duo, which has double teams. And you can look these plays up online and get easy explanations of those. And I'll spend some more time with these as we get toward camp in terms of the Patreon for the video stuff for those of you who are subscribers there. But they use duo, they use power O. They're going to do a lot of things to get double teams at the point of attack, which means that you're not asking your offensive tackles to do as much. You're not asking any of your offensive linemen in terms of frequency. You're not asking your offensive linemen in general to do as much in terms of holding up one-on-one, because you're just getting a lot of double teams. And so that's part of it. In the run game, you're getting so many double teams that does help out. But as with any other offense, there are times where the tackles aren't going to have help in the run game. I posted a photo, a screenshot of one play, in which it's the Akers touchdown, in the spring game, the one, in the second quarter. And you can see that they have both tackles are single blocking, and the one tackle on the backside actually has a reach block. That's a tough block in any offense, and in the running game, that's a tough block. And so there are going to be times where they're doing that, but they do get double teams in that particular play. It's just they're not helping the tackles there. But also, again, the tackles are more cutoff blocks there, and you've got one reach block that's just trying to keep the backside end from getting down the line of scrimmage. Those you're going to have to, you can't run a modern running game without having some of that. And, they're using more zone, particularly more outside zone than they ever did before in the Briles system. I mean, it used to be just straight inside zone and dart and power and all basically A gap and some B gap running, very little outside that. They've diversified a little bit because of how teams have started defending him. So it's not exactly accurate to say that they're not going to put any load on the offensive tackles at all. There's just a little bit in terms of percentages, they're asking less from them in the running game. And then in the passing game, the big issue there is that they run so many screens. The Brile system, there's so many screens and so much quick game. And then the rest of the offense is basically play action passing. So when you're getting a lot of play action, you're not asking your offensive tackles to do just a straight pass set and block for, say, a 5 or 7 step drop where there's no run responsibility for the defensive end. So in that sense, the tackles don't have to hold up in the same way as a standard, say, Jimbo Fisher style pass offense, where you're asking the quarterback to drop back. There's not a whole lot of run action on a number of plays. You're throwing more intermediate. There's more risk involved in terms of what you're asking your offensive line to do there. In the Brile system, you're running the ball with a bunch of double teams, and then you are play action, passing, and trying to get the ball down the field, or you're throwing some screens and some quick game stuff. I mean, there's not as much intermediate stuff. You do have it with Y cross and some shallows and things like that. You're getting some of that in there, but even a lot of that is going to be off of your play action, because so much of what they do is predicated on their ability to run the football out of those spread sets. So yeah, it does put less stress on the offensive tackles than most offenses. Here's where, though, as encouraging as that may sound for a lot of people, here's where that gets maybe less encouraging, is that the same, almost all of that can be said for the Willie Taggart offense that he ran last year, which was heavily influenced by the Brile system. The running game that Briles has brought, that Clements is coaching up on the run game side, they do more. It's a more vertical run game, more vertical displacement than what Taggart used. But otherwise, I mean, in terms of the requirements for the offensive tackles, it's fairly similar. So that tells you that if you're going to have just downright abominable tackle play, it's going to cost you wins. In the Brile system, in any system, you have to be able to block the edge. So hopefully that helps answer that. And I know there's a lot of people who've had similar questions to that, so I figured I'd address that now before we get too far into the season. I did get another question about some personnel issues. I mean, I was asked about whether Boselli, who's now back now as a walk-on, is, you know, an option, whether he could play tackle. And honestly, my answer to that is I don't think so. I think best case scenario is that Boselli ends up being a solid backup option at guard or at center behind Baby-on Johnson. That said, Boselli did look pretty decent and looked a lot better than I expected in the spring game as the center for his side. And if Baby-on Johnson should happen to go down or doesn't play especially well, Boselli at least gives you a decent option at center that's not necessarily going to get you hurt, not necessarily going to get you killed. So I think that's most likely going to be his role. Best case scenario is that he's actually just a backup. But if other scenarios hit and they need somebody else at center, then he at least gives you a viable option there. And that's really important for depth. In terms of the offensive tackles, honestly, it starts with Roberts, as we know, the transfer from Northern Illinois. He's going to be at one of the tackles, whether he can move to left tackle or whether he stays at right tackle like he was at Northern Illinois, and he can be a decent player there. He's not going to be an All-American, but he can be a good player for you there. You know, he can at least be decent, be better than what you had last year. The real question is the next guy, and I think you're going to get the other player out of the following four, and that is Juwan Williams, Abdul Bello, Evan, or I keep doing that. It's not Evan Neal, as much as we would all like it to be Evan Neal. I've done this for weeks. It's Chaz Neal. It's either Juwan Williams, Abdul Bello, Chaz Neal, or Brady Scott. That's going to be that second tackle, almost certainly. And Scott, I think, is more likely to be at one of the guards. So really, I think that other tackle is probably going to be Juwan Williams, Chaz Neal, or Abdul Bello. My money right now, based on a few factors, is that Juwan Williams is probably going to get the first crack at it, which is frightening given how he played last year. But there was significant improvement in the spring game based on what he showed last year. The question is, will that persist? Will that continue when the lights go on and when the pressure gets on in real games next year? Which is where, you know, a lot of times he would just forget technique and just, you know, once he'd rat trap mentally, it was trouble. And if that happens, I think the next guy is going to be Chaz Neal. I think, again, based on some of the stuff that I saw when I was down in Tallahassee, based on some of this stuff that I've been breaking down in the spring game. And then also I talked to a scout who was in Tallahassee a couple weeks ago, who he said he saw Chaz Neal and couldn't believe it. He's like, that kid looks like he's a future NFL guy. Just physically, he looks so good. And he was really surprised. He's like, man, he's got length. He's got the frame. He, you know, from what he could tell, he had some, you know, bend to him. You know, I don't know exactly what he saw, but, you know, he said he looked like that kind of player on the hoof. You know, he's over 300 pounds at this point at 6'7". The frame is there. A lot of the physical tools are there. It's just a matter of, and he's been playing tackle for a little over a year, you know, basically hasn't really been an offensive guy before that. So got a long way to go. That said, he's got fewer bad habits to break. So sometimes a guy like Clemens can look at a guy like that and be like, look, you've got a chance to be an NFL kid. If you work really, really hard over the summer and you get strong enough to be where we want you to be, then I can roll with you as a redshirt freshman. And now I've got my guy because you just keep doing what I'm telling you to do, and you don't have all the bad habits to break that some of these other guys do. So I wouldn't be shocked if it was a guy like Evan Neal, or geez, I did it again, like Chaz Neal. Jalen Goss would be up there, but I just don't think he's heavy enough at this stage. I think he's got another year to gain the necessary weight. But again, you know, we'll see what he ends up coming into camp at. I think he's closer to like 270 right now. And I just don't think that's going to be heavy enough for what they're asking the tackles to do. I mean, they do want tackles who can drive you in the running game. And I think that's going to be the thing that keeps Goss off the field for at least one more year. So that's where I think things sit at the offensive line position. Like I said, I've gotten a bunch of questions about this stuff, and you know, that's as I've been going through the footage of the spring game and talking to some people, that's where I think things stand at the moment. So before we move on, I do want to thank my next sponsor, and that is Garage Makeovers. They are the top garage remodeling company in South Florida, according to both Home Advisor and Angie's List. They've been serving all of Palm Beach County and Broward County since 2005. If you have any needs in your garage, you need to call Nathan at Garage Makeovers. Let him know that the Unconquered podcast sent you. Phone number and information is in the show notes, or are in the show notes. How's that for grammar? Anyhow, a few other things before we move on any further, and that is there's been a little bit of an uptick on the recruiting trail. They've done pretty well in terms of coming off of a 5-7 season. So a lot to be encouraged about there. But since we last talked, Ja'Kai Douglas, I think it's Ja'Kai. It might be Ja'Ki, but I'm pretty sure Ja'Kai is how you'd probably say that. 5'9 slot receiver from Louisiana. Like the kid, football player. Similar in some ways to Keyshawn Helton. Just not quite as fast, I don't think. You know, he's an 11.01 100-meter guy. So, you know, good, but not outstanding, not, you know, exceptional speed, good enough. But very clearly a very strong and thicker than you'd expect kid who every time who's playing high level Louisiana football, and every time you see him in his huddle stuff, he seems to be pulling away from guys. So that tells you something about how he carries his pads. So he'll fit really well in what they want to do. Good pickup, not a kid that I would mark as elite, but again, the kind of player that in their system, you need to have those kind of guys. Having more Keyshawn Helton types does not hurt you. Then also Carter Boatwright, tight end from Colquitt County in Moultrie. top level high school you want to have good connections with, and they've done a very good job of maintaining relationships there. Boatwright, as a 6'5", 225, 230 tight end, one of those, you know, you can insert all of your white tight end stereotypes, you know, a real lunch pail guy, really, you know, blocks well, you know, soft hands, et cetera. All of that stuff kind of comes off the tape when you watch Colquitt County, when you watch him at Colquitt County. But and again, they're top division in Georgia play, you know, very, very good competition there. One of the things that sticks out to me about him, though, is, again, I look at him and I say football player. He's a guy that, you know, you see him lined up at defensive end on those on his huddle stuff and coming off the edge. You see him blocking guys downfield. You see him blocking in line. You see him making catches. You see him whatever his team needs to be done that is within the kind of thing you would expect from a big framed guy, he's doing. And again, that's been one of the issues that they've had is they've not always gone and gotten in recent years guys that you just say, that's a football player. And this kid's a football player. And, you know, you need more of those guys on the roster. You know, I think he's the kind of high floor type kid that you bring in, and depending on what the need is at tight end, you know, he offers you, he's not Trey McKitty. He's not going to be that downfield tight end, but he does bring you a blocking H-back. He brings you an inline tight end. He brings you some of that. If he doesn't, if he outgrows the position, then he becomes something else. Maybe you line him up at a strong side defensive end. I don't think that's where he would end up. I'm not sure how, whether he's explosive enough for that, but he's a good enough athlete that again, you're bringing in a guy that I think provides some stability, either at the tight end position, which I think is where he sticks, or eventually grows into something else. And I think that, you know, you're in pretty good shape if you're taking those guys, as the glue guys in your class. And that's something that's really, really important in every class. If you take, just look at, you know, the end of the Jimbo Fisher era, look at the end of the Urban Meyer era at Florida. And I thought it was actually a really insightful comment, recently, somebody on and we'll get to this in a moment, but in response to some of the articles that were released about the end of the Jimbo year at Florida State recently, somebody said Jimbo Fisher is Florida State's Urban Meyer. And in so many ways that comparison is apt in terms of Jimbo Fisher at Florida State and Urban Meyer at Florida. But you look at Urban's recruiting at the end of the Florida, of his time at Florida, and they were bringing in just classes loaded with blue chips, and then they had all sorts of problems. And that's one of those things. I mean, if you're not going to run things like Saban, where you can basically cherry pick the very best of the very best and then cut bait as soon as they don't work on campus, then you need to have a little bit of balance in your class. You have to you have to balance the elite high ceiling kids. You have along some of whom may have a little bit lower floor. You have to, you know, the potential knucklehead potential. You have your truly elite, almost can't miss kids. You're, you know, if he stays healthy, he's going to be in the NFL. Your Akeem Dent or your Travis J type kids from the last class. Your Marvin Wilsons. You need those kids. You have to have them, or you're not gonna win championships without those kids. But then you also need the kids that are the three-star, you know, blue collar type kid, the kid who provides some stability in the locker room, the kid who, if the four-star or five-star kid doesn't take care of business, he's going to take his job. When you think about, look at Clemson and some of the guys that they've had who've been influential, who've been critical to their success. They haven't all been four and five stars. Some of those guys have been walk-ons. I mean, you look at their slot receivers and, you know, they've had some pretty infuriatingly good players that were not highly ranked coming out of high school. Or if you go back to the 2013 team, Terrence Brooks, a three-star safety, is ranked, I'm looking right now at the 24/7 composite rankings from that year. He was 437th nationally, 30th at his position. But you've got to have a Terrence Brooks who can come in and be a stable player, and he ended up being more than that. But you've got to be able to bring some of those guys in that are football players that you can count on bringing it every day in practice and consistently going to and is going to be a guy that's going to improve. And ideally, you bring those guys in who either have the frame or the speed to be something more than just a practice player. You don't want to bring a guy in who's just a practice player. And we can look at a few examples where the Fisher staff brought in some guys that were reaches in terms of, you know, trying to bring some of these types of glue guys in, and they ended up being dead weight on the roster for 4 or 5 years. And I don't think Carter Boatwright is going to be that, right? You're not getting that with him. You're getting a kid that is a football player who at worst is going to be a backup tight end who you can use in goal line scenarios and so on. At best, you know, maybe blows up and becomes a you know, he grows and adds 50, 60 pounds and becomes your stereotypical three-star hidden gem first-round offensive tackle in a few years. Again, I don't think you can expect that with him. But again, that's the kind of thing they're doing, is they're pulling in a football player here. And you can say that there's something similar about the next guy that they brought in, and that's Alex Akavage from Pennsylvania, now at IMG. Played low-level football, you know, competition level in Pennsylvania, wasn't very good. But you're looking at a kid that's 6'5", 285. And has been getting in progressively better shape. And, you know, you're getting in pretty early on this kid, but he's the kind of kid, if you look at that, that frame is exactly what you want. And, you know, I've been saying for years that so often the places where people miss when they're projecting high school offensive linemen is it's really easy to get excited about the 320-pound kid that's pancaking everybody in his high school film. Well, yeah, that's because he's 100 pounds bigger than the guy he's blocking. But then that guy gets into college and he starts out at 320 and he winds up at 360 by, you know, his second year of, you know, pledging a fraternity or whatever. And now you've got a tub of lard that you can't really develop. Ideally, you get kids, again, your Jalen Gosses, you get, you know, those types of kids that come in maybe, you know, 20, 30 pounds light. And 2 years later, they're in the ballpark of where you want them. And 3 years later, they're ready to play. And that's basically what you're looking at with a guy like Akavage. And that's why I don't think it's really worth spending too much time worrying about rankings or anything like that at this stage. Though I'm sure that they're going to get him in for camp and they'll see how he works with that. But that's what they're doing in this. And again, the one thing that I will give this staff a lot of credit for is they have a very clearly unified perspective and theory on how they're recruiting. And that is, they are recruiting football players first and foremost. And I can tell you that is going to be coming straight from Dave Kelly as much as anybody else. But they're getting football players first and foremost. They're not just going and finding track kids or measurement guys or guys that are 4 or 5 stars. The first thing that they're looking for. And you know, I've interacted with Dave because I've got a few players that are going to be Division I players next year that I coached the last couple of years at wide receiver. I've been in touch with a number of coaches, and one of the first things that you learn in talking to some of these guys is you learn about what their priorities are in terms of the kinds of guys that they want to recruit. Some guys are all about the measurements. What do you run? Dave Kelly and the Florida State staff are, is he a dog? They want to know whether or not he's a football player. And then, yeah, there are certain measurements and things that they're going to pay close attention to, but that's the first thing they want to know. And then, of course, they want to know about academics or any of those things. But they want to know, is he a dog? Is he a player? Because they don't want others. And, you know, there was a recent article on 24/7 Sports about how some other programs, they've taken to recruiting based on trying to get the fastest guys or you know, basically just going off of measurables and then trying to teach guys to play. It's a little bit of a different approach from what Florida State's taking. Florida State is not going out and saying, okay, well, this kid runs 10-3. He can't play football yet, but we're going to get him there. They're doing the opposite. They're saying, well, he's a 4-5 instead of a 4-4. But his 4.5 is a lot better than this kid's 4.4 because he's a football player. This is the kid that if you lock him in a phone booth with the other kid, this is the and only one can come out. This is the kid that's walking out. That's what they're looking for. Oh, I'm sorry. For those of you who are on the younger side, phone booths are there. This is before there were mobile phones, before cellular phones and all of that, there used to be phones that actually had cords on them and everything. And you had to pay money to use them. And you know, they often had a metered rate and all of that. So yeah, really important. You might want to go and watch like old Superman stuff. You'll get to see what those are anyway. So we're going to wrap up with the last few things, and these are more general things. One is I talked to somebody in the athletic department a couple weeks ago about some general stuff in terms of finances and some of these other things, and talking about, this was after on the last podcast we talked about Florida State resetting and reestablishing, resituating the relationship between the athletic department and the booster club, modernizing that to match more closely with what like University of Florida and other athletic department and booster club arrangements look like. And that being a very, very important thing for Florida State, especially in order to attract a top flight athletic director once Thrasher steps down as the university president. So that was a big deal. But there were some other things that I also, I ended up talking to somebody about that were not exactly related to that, but were tangential and were important in terms of thinking about where the athletic department is. And we've talked a lot on this podcast, and I know lots of others have talked about this in terms of Florida State being very cash strapped and all of that. And even having, you know, being in the red the last couple of years. And the person I talked to actually had a good bit to say about this. And one of the things that this actually relates to is toward the tail end of the Stan Wilcox era, the boosters had, and again, this gets to some of the disconnect between the athletic department and the boosters, which is being fixed. But the boosters were told, going back to like 2015 area, they were told that the ACC network was on its way and to expect the ACC, this is the very top level boosters, they were told to basically expect the ACC network to release around 2017 and that the that Florida State would be getting an extra $1 million from in terms of revenue from that each of the years after that. And so the boosters were expecting that extra $1 million in the budget for 2017, 2018, 2019, and they took that $1 million that would have otherwise been in that budget and they invested it and they did some other things with that $1 million looking forward. And then the ACC network didn't release until now it's going to be releasing next month. So that explains how really tight the budget has been over the past few years. At least that's how it was explained to me. And the real question is how much money are they going to get from the ACC network in the first year of operation? Is that going to match the million or million plus expectation that that they were told, or, you know, is it going to be more? I mean, obviously the, SEC network is, you know, making almost 10 times that at this point per institution. So that's something that to monitor. That's something that did have its impact, a negative impact in terms of poor communication, poor setting of expectations, and that leading to some planning that didn't quite work in terms of where budgets went. Now, I also was told that a number of ACC programs, number of schools are nowhere close to where they're supposed to be contractually in terms of what their responsibilities are for being able to handle the ACC network, because a lot of the production of the ACC network, and in fact, pretty much all of it for a large percentage of the broadcasts, is going to be done by the institutions themselves. So Seminole Productions, basically, you know, Florida State is going to be handling the broadcasts on the ACC network that are on the Florida State campus. That means that you have to have control rooms. That means you have to have the ability to do all of the things that, generally speaking, the network trucks and all that come in and they're ready to do, you have to have the camera equipment. You have to, and so there's a pretty significant outlay of, there's a pretty significant investment in the necessary technology that has to be put out there in order to handle, in order to be able to run the ACC network the way that ESPN wants it to be done. So that also has led to a significant amount of expenditure. And person I talked to felt that there were some ways in which money was spent for the AC for preparing for the ACC network that were not ideal, that the money was not all spent especially well, and that there were certain things where they went and got the very top of the line kind of equipment where that wasn't actually as necessary as just getting some of the basics taken care of, and then eventually you could potentially move up to some of that stuff if you wanted to, but it wasn't as necessary as what some of the decision makers felt. So there's, again, some a pretty significant budgetary outlay that went towards some of that preparation. And that's one of the reasons why the ACC network in that first year, there's going to be some costs involved, because you've got to pay the people, the institutions have to pay the people that are actually on air, that are running camera, that are doing all those things, or you can just use student interns and all that, but then you're not going to get the product that ESPN wants, and that's going to actually lead to the success in the network. So that's going to impact, especially in early on in year one, that's going to impact how much revenue they're going to be able to bring in from the ACC network initially. Those costs are going to diminish moving forward as that foundation is laid. And that's one of the reasons why you expect that first year to be a little bit less in terms of profit brought into the athletic department as what you would expect in future years. So that'll be something interesting to keep an eye on in terms of the ACC network moving forward. Though I think ultimately the ACC network is slated to be fairly successful, partly because the ACC, again, you got to remember these networks. Yes, the ACC is not the SEC in terms of football and in terms of football following, but in terms of inventory, what actually runs on these networks as often as not is not football. It's the other sports, the other inventory, your tier three inventory that really matters. And the ACC is very strong in a number of those, particularly in basketball, which has a lot of inventory, and in some populated areas as well. So it'd be interesting to see how that comes out. And I think the ACC in that regard is better situated than a lot of analysts over the past few years have suggested. But yeah, so that's one bit in terms of that discussion with that athletic department source about some of those things. The second bit is that there's still a good amount of turnover coming in terms of some key administrators in the athletic department, some relatively powerful people who've been in place for a while. There's some people who are going to be retiring. There's some people who are going to be offered early retirement, as it were. And ultimately, they're trying to both tighten the belt. And Coburn is really more interested in making sure that he can get people who are going to be efficient and effective within budget. And if you can't do that, then maybe we need someone who's younger, who's been elsewhere, and knows how to do this in a way that's going to be more efficient and effective. There's my source expressed some ambivalence about this. I mean, on the one hand, that's a real positive. You want people who are good at their jobs, who haven't been mailing it in for 10, 15 years, and there's a lot of those people at Florida State. And on the flip side, that also changes, that takes things from Florida State's long had a very family oriented family kind of feel in the athletic department. And a lot of that old guard was part of that. And when you start to handle things a little differently, then you're bringing in more of a mercenary population. And then, a lot of that family culture can go, but there tends to go, but I think the way I feel about this is that if you focus on making sure you bring in the very best people, A players attract A players, and you can have a good culture, a family culture of A players that actually lead to better results. And that's something that the athletic department is trying to do at this point. Though, again, a lot of this has more to do with trying to trim some fat first before they can begin to attract people from the outside. So, again, really interesting stuff passed on by the folks in the athletic department on that. Final couple things. I think a bunch of you, I'm sure, read the Matt Hayes piece on Jimbo Fisher's last time at Florida State. And what made that interesting, I mean, anybody who's listened to this podcast or others and has kept up with this, I mean, none of that stuff should be especially surprising. You know, the discussion of where Florida State was situated academically in terms of APR and all of that. Yeah, you know, that was something we discussed on this podcast. And, you know, the bind that Taggart and his staff were in when they arrived culturally and their inability to handle some of that because of the APR stuff we've discussed on this podcast. So that stuff wasn't especially new. What was really interesting, though, was getting some former assistants on the record and getting, you know, you're sitting AD on the record on some of this stuff, which tells you that they're, you know, trying to deal with damage control and trying to get ahead of the narrative. And that's something that, honestly, when did you ever see, say, Stan Wilcox do that? Try to get ahead of the narrative on something? Try to actually, you know, through talking to the media, actually ensuring that, you know, a narrative that is not harmful to the university is given at least some consideration by the media. That you know, seems like a good idea for an athletic director. So that's worth noting. I have my theories, by the way, on who actually talked to who these anonymous folks who talked to Matt Hayes were, but I will not speculate about that on air. I think it's yeah. Well, we'll just leave it at that. But. Yeah, some really interesting stuff there. I do know that there were a number of people who were, a number of fans were put off by the way that the former Jimbo assistant referred to Jameis Winston as basically the beginning of the end there, as the instigator, as the primary reason why things fell apart. That basically Jimbo allowed him to get away with murder, and so other people, you know, others followed suit, and some have protested that, well, you know, Jameis was such a great leader, really. I mean, how is that the case? But I have to emphasize that Winston was a great quarterback and he was a vocal leader, but the leaders on that team were, Jameis Winston was not one of the leaders on the 2013 team. He wasn't. He was a freshman and he spoke. He was the guy who got the attention in the media for being a vocal leader, but the leaders in that locker room were LaMarcus Joyner, Telvin Smith, and Timmy Jernigan, but especially Joyner and Smith. LaMarcus and Telvin were the leaders of that team, and when they left after the 2013 season, that's when things went downhill, because then you did have Jameis basically as the primary leader of that team. And Jameis, you know, he's got certain things as a leader that are his, that are real qualities. And that, but at the same time, he was also a goof. And the thing about LaMarcus and about Telvin is they were professionals. They came in and they were going to handle business. And if you weren't going to do it, then they were going to fight you. Whereas Jameis wasn't even on the team about half the year because he was playing baseball. And this was something that was told to me at that time. I mean, you can go back to my 2014 podcasts and listen to this, where, you know, I was pointing out, listen, the leaders from last year, I mean, I remember Candy Fisher when I asked them after, this was after the Clemson game, I asked, you know, how are they going to handle the success? And Candy Fisher pointed to them, to Telvin and to LaMarcus, and said, those two won't let us lose. And she was right. But it was those guys that were the leaders at that time. When those guys left, and we talked about this again in 2014, we talked about it in 2015 on this podcast, when those guys left and then it became Jameis Winston and Mario Edwards Jr.'s team, well, the difference went from guys who were taking things, who were approaching things as true professionals, who are approaching things as with discipline, with hunger, to guys who are interested in, you know, playing, you know, fooling around, enjoying themselves. And yeah, that was tolerated. And, you know, again, we talked about this last year at the beginning of the season, that the problem that Taggart was going to have was not that practices were no fun, or that the team, you know, had been browbeaten or whatnot. The problem was that the team was undisciplined, and that discipline had been allowed to slide for years. And we talked about this last year. So a lot of that stuff in that article was spot on. And actually the criticisms of Jameis as a key player in all of that, they weren't inaccurate. Now, there were other players involved that were also ringleaders on that 2014 team in particular. And we've talked about this on this podcast, but there were other players in addition to Jameis that were leaders that led things off the cliff because they were more interested, like I said, in fooling around. And if you talk to some of the people around the program, trying to keep these guys out of trouble, or, you know, get them out of trouble at different points was a real task at the time. I mean, I know some of the people who were involved in that, and they were frustrated as all get out with some of these guys, and frustrated that some of it wasn't being dealt with. And some of it goes back to when Monk Bonasort got sick, and when he no longer was the guy that was able to stand up and tell Jimbo Fisher, no, you have to kick Greg Reed off the team. You don't have a choice. When Monk was gone, well, Jimbo ran it the way that he wanted to on that. And ultimately he was going to be more permissive on that. He wasn't willing to make that sacrifice. Whereas with Monk, and I still think that Monk's insistence on standing up to Jimbo and shouting him down and basically saying, you have to hold him accountable. If you don't hold him accountable, we'll lose them all, leading to Greg Reed being kicked off the team. If that doesn't happen, they don't win the national title in 2013. Because that set the discipline example, and that allowed somebody like LaMarcus and somebody like Telvin to be the guys that everybody looked up to. And it went the opposite way after 2014. And I think that article basically hit it on the head in that regard. The real question is whether or not Taggart and his staff are going to be able to get all that flipped in time to be able to get the kind of players in recruiting that they need to. It's hard once you're out of school for more than a year or two to get the kind of increase in recruiting that you need to get those elites. But, you know, we'll see this year. We'll see a lot this year. And if they're able to get a good product from Briles and Clements on the field, and able to get a couple elite kids, you know, toward the tail end of recruiting, then, you know, we'll see how things turn. Well, that's all we got for today, but I want to thank once again my sponsors, Lewis Marquez of Keller Williams Realty in Jacksonville, Florida, Garage Makeovers, and also EPR Creations. If you need any sort of internet marketing, or if you need a new website, you need to talk to EPR Creations, best in the business and very affordable. Give them a call, tell them the Unconquered Podcast sent you, and they'll take care of you. And oh man, I was done with this episode, and now I have to break back in just because of the Carlos Williams interview that was just posted that I got a look at, where where Carlos explains that the fake punt reverse that was called in the national championship game just before halftime that was instrumental to the comeback win. Never should have been a comeback because they never should have allowed the signals to be stolen. But anyway, I digress. That call was actually something that, according to Carlos, was something that Jimbo Fisher didn't even know was coming. That Jimbo had called for the punt, and that Charles Kelly, who was in charge of special teams then, and we've talked plenty on this podcast about how good a special teams coach Charles Kelly was, and how much the special teams fell off after he moved on to defensive coordinator. So it was a double whammy. losing him as special teams coach. But that was Charles Kelly's call, apparently. And Williams said, and I quote, "When the ball was snapped, you could hear Coach Fisher screaming, 'No, no, 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 no.'" And then it worked. And he said, yeah, so then that, you know, that was all fine. But he said, as far as he knows, Jimbo didn't know the call was coming and that it was Charles Kelly's call, and the rest is history. So those of you out there who, you know, had nothing good to say about Charles Kelly, well, now you know that that Charles Kelly was the mastermind responsible for that call, at least according to Carlos Williams. And I don't think there's any reason to necessarily question his account here. At any rate, it is hilarious. And I should mention, you know, there was a similar moment in a playoff game last year that I was coaching in. I was our special teams coordinator, and I had noticed during the game, and we'd prepared our team for it, that they tended to not to defend the edges real well on their punt block or their punt return. And I told our punter, who was also our tailback, listen, you know, if we get there and I give you the green light, and you see them, you know, playing real soft on that edge, you just take off. If it's, you know, if you think you can get it, just do it. And, he went ahead and did it. And our head coach didn't know it was coming. And, I hear, no, oh, wow. And, our kid went for 40 yards. And, honestly, I wasn't sure it was coming on that. I didn't know it was coming either, but, you know, players make plays and makes a big difference. So, hilarious stuff from Carlos Williams. Worthwhile to discuss that before leaving. Once again, you've been listening to the Unconquered Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Staples. Thanks for listening.
Thank you all very much, and have a great day if you want to.